Oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Court's oral submission docket is as follows. Parkway Company of Texas Incorporated and Sugar Creek Corporation versus Ray Woodruff and Constance Woodruff Presley, Michelson and Klein Incorporated and Van Sickle Michelson and Klein Incorporated from Fort Bend County, B.J. Daniel Jr. and Pamela Shamrod Daniel versus Tom Yarbrough from Harris County, and Sharon P. Thomas and Alice McNeil versus Howard Oldham in the City of Houston from Harris County, consolidated for oral arguments with Daniel Gibson versus Candace Cathamay Spinks from Cameron County. The court will hear oral argument in each of these causes. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each cause. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape, you may make application with our clerk. In the first cause, the court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument, and the petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Parkway versus Woodruff.
May it please the court, Mr. Randall Wilkins will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Please, the court. My name is Randy Wilkins, and I represent the petitioner Parkway Company, Inc., the defendant in the trial court, and the developer of the property in this case. The core of this case involves allegations that my client, a residential developer, permanently damaged the Woodruff's home and lot by negligently diverting the flow of surface water under their property. My clients do not concede they were negligent, but they do concede that there was conflicting evidence on those issues and that they cannot contest the jury findings, and they're not doing that on this appeal. The issues that they do wish to appeal, and they want to strongly contest, are first, they can be broken down into three basic categories. First, that the findings and judgment that my client violated the DCPA, thus allowing the recovery of additional damages and attorney's fees, was improper, because this is not a DCPA case. It's a negligence case. It doesn't meet any of the requirements for a DCPA case, stated broadly.
Counsel, you concede that judgment should be rendered against your client in some amount based on the findings?
Yes, Your Honor. I see no, based on the rules of legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence, I don't think we have a claim that the jury could not have found negligence in this case.
Okay, but you say that would, you concede only that a judgment should be rendered on the negligence finding?
That's correct. The second broad category of issue in this appeal is the judgments below improperly permit a double recovery of damages, which is contrary to the express ruling by this court in Lutt v. McCollum. And the third broad general issue is the propriety of awarding a contingent attorney's fee instead of requiring the plaintiff to prove up a reasonable hourly fee. The Woodruffs have conditionally appealed sought writ on the ruling that by the Court of Appeals that there was no evidence to support the finding of mental anguish or mental anguish damages. I want to open on my first three broad categories, and if the Court permits, I will reserve any argument regarding mental anguish damages to rebuttal. I begin with, on the issue of DCPA recovery, the first question is whether or not the Woodruffs for consumers under the DTPA. It is our contention they were not consumers because they don't meet both prongs of the test. The two prongs are the consumer must have sought or acquired goods or services. And the second prong has been stated in two ways, as I understand it, by this court. First, that the goods or services which required must be the subject of the complaint. And what I think is just another way of stating that, the DTPA violation must be in connection with the transaction in which the consumer sought or acquired goods or services.
Did the consumer in Chastain and Cameron, or for that matter, I guess Smith and Baldwin, meet the requirement the way you just stated it?
In Chastain, there was an argument that they did not, they were complaining about what someone did with another lot that they did not purchase, which impacted their lot. And so there was an argument that was made that they did not meet the consumer requirement because they were not complaining about the goods that they purchased. The court denied that argument. This court denied that argument. But also in the facts of that case, there was a finding that deceptive or conduct violating the DTPA was done in the course of the transaction in which the consumer purchased the property. They were told that the third lot would never be used for certain purposes, commercial purposes. And then when there was a dispute arose, they were told that if they didn't shut up and go away, the person who sold them the lot was going to build a machine shop, or I may have that background, but something horrible on the lot next to them. So there was evidence of this connection, direct connection of the conduct allegedly violating the DTPA and the transaction in which the consumer bought the good. In the Parks case, there was a direct connection because there was an alleged misrepresentation by the developer that allegedly caused the consumer to buy the property, as I recall, or at least by the defendant, whether it was the developer or someone else. But there was an alleged misrepresentation before the property was purchased, which induced the consumer to purchase the property. Smith v. Baldwin, as I recall, involved a dispute about repair services, about the construction of a house, and whether or not that house should be constructed in accordance with certain building codes. And so in that case, it involved, as I recall, not a warranty, but a misrepresentation that the house would be constructed in accordance with certain building codes. So again, there was a misrepresentation that was made that could be said to have induced the consumer to enter into the consumer transaction. In this case, we don't have that. The Woodruffs bought their house in 1981, approximately 4 years after the lot was first sold by my client to the builder, approximately 3 years after the house was built, and they were the fourth occupants of the house. The testimony was that they had no contact with my client, Sugar Creek, or which subsequently became Parkway, prior to buying the house, and no contact with my client affected their decision to buy the house. Secondly, there's no evidence that my client engaged in any violation of the DTPA that induced them to buy their house or that in any way affected their decision to buy that house. The Court of Appeals relied upon the testimony that this was a master plan community, and the plaintiffs have understandably pointed that up in their brief. However, I would point out to the court that the jury refused to find that my client made any misrepresentations about the quality of their goods or services. And in my mind, a statement, if master plan community has some meaning that can be enforced by a court, then it's either an express warranty or it's an affirmative misrepresentation. But that theory is expressly prohibited by the jury's verdict in this case.
Counsel, can you articulate a bright line that you propose that we draw a limitation on the language that the goods or services be connected with, there be some connection with the sale or of goods or services?
To me, the only logical line is probably the best line, which is probably prohibited by case precedent at this point, would be that there be a connection between the purchaser and the seller.
You mean privity?
Yes. Privity or something very close to it.
Well, you acknowledge that that would be contrary to cases that we've already written on. I mean, there's the Court of Appeals in dealing with this talks about cases which refer to inextricably intertwined, and but here appears to have used the standard of would the developer have benefited in some way from the sale. Can you propose to us some bright line given the current state of our jurisprudence?
Well,
or is there no limitation?
I don't think there is a bright line. I think there are some cases a real estate agent who makes false representations in connection with the sale of property clearly should be held liable even though they're not in privity. They have a direct interest in that specific transaction as opposed to some indirect benefit that's proposed in this case. I would point out, I would argue that let's say the owner of a shopping center in the neighborhood also indirectly benefits from the sale of a lot in that neighborhood. The neighbors in that neighborhood indirectly benefit from the sale of a lot in that neighborhood because it's going to either maintain or increase their property value. If no lot is sold, their property value, they're also going to go down. Does that mean that a neighbor, if he somehow damages his neighbor's property, is going to be held liable under the DCPA? There's no privity required.
Privity is basically what you argued to the Court of Appeals, isn't it?
No. The point I've been trying to make throughout this appeal, in the Court of Appeals and here, is that this is not a privity case. And because there was no connection whatsoever between Parkway and the decision to buy that house.
Well, when a consumer goes down and buys a new Ford pickup, there's no connection directly between the consumer and Ford manufacturer.
Well, there is in that the Ford manufacturer has manufactured the vehicle that's been sold to the consumer.
And in this case, did your client manufacture the subdivision that the house was located in?
Yes, and there was no defect in that subdivision at the time that consumer bought the house. That's the difference. The Court of Appeals in this case implied a warranty as to future services. And all the case law that I've been able to find, even where it's been extended, involves existing defects. Defects that exist at the time of the transaction in order to find an implied warranty. And I would include in that Melody Homes. Although Melody Homes speaks in terms of services to be provided, it seems to be not much of a stretch to say that the real warranty being provided in Melody Homes is that once those services are provided and given to the consumer or made available to the consumer, there's your end point, and it's at that point that there has to be some defect in the way those services were performed, not some indefinite future performance, which is what the Court of Appeals ended up holding in this case.
Will we have to disapprove of the Luker decision?
Not at all, Your Honor. I would urge you to disapprove of the Luker decision because I don't think this state needs another implied warranty to foment additional litigation. But Luker is distinguishable because it involved an existing defect. The defect in Luker v. Arnold was that the lots that were sold to the builder were not large enough to hold a septic tank drainage field, as I understand it, that was required by some county regulation. And therefore, from the moment they were sold by the developer, they were defective. They had a defect. They weren't big enough. You couldn't put a septic tank system on them, even though that was the plan to provide sewage to those lots. And therefore, it's assumed from this case because as far as the evidence shows and as far as the jury found, there was nothing wrong with that lot when the Woodruffs bought it 2.5 years before they were flooded.
And Mr. Wilkins,
following up on that, then how do you respond to the Woodruff's argument raised in their brief that if the developer, well, in essence, the argument is this, the developer has a big plot of land and grades out one lot and sells it to a builder and the builder builds on it. Your argument is that that's the end of the transaction. Any subsequent event, such as building an adjacent lot that causes flooding, isn't an extension of that commercial transaction. Therefore, the buyers of the original house are not consumers. But the argument raised in brief is, well, suppose the developer, knowing that, wants to develop a whole parcel of land, develops that lot, grades it out, sells it, and then the next day goes out and grades another lot and sells it without any consideration of the runoff on the plot that's previously been developed. Is the developer to be relieved of any DTPA obligation going in simply because the second lot that they're grading is a subsequent event to the sale of the first lot? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. The problem with that argument, I think, is just economic reality and economic practicality. And even, I realize you're making it very simple in one lot for purpose of argument, but even if you narrow it to a few lots to avoid this potential liability, it's just not economically feasible for a developer to go out and get financing to buy a few lots at a time. He can't get the financing to buy large tracts unless he has some overall plan. He can't get an overall plan unless he's gone to the appropriate local, state, and federal authorities and got permission to subdivide the land, shown what the lot sizes are going to be, shown where the streets are going to be, shown how he's going to drain it, shown how he's going to provide sewage treatment, shown how he's not going to interfere with the snail daughter, shown how he's not going to destroy too many trees, et cetera, et cetera. So that it would be, in my view, impractical, if not impossible, for a developer to take the approach of only developing one lot or a few lots at a time in order to avoid this potential liability.
Well, actually, my question was going the other direction. I'm assuming that the developer has a big plot or plat that's been accepted. The problem is that the things here is that the developer then grades a few of them, gets those sold off, and then without consideration of what was previously done, alters the plat to make a few other lots acceptably saleable, which adversely impacts on the first lots that were sold.
The problem is, he wouldn't be allowed to do that because he has to submit an overall drainage plan to get his original plat approved, to get his original financing to do his deal. And secondly, he wouldn't skate free because he would be subject to water code if he diverts water across somebody's property. There's water code liability. If he's subject to negligence liability, we don't dispute that there would be a cause of action for negligence.
I'm sorry, I may not be understanding really. Maybe I need to clarify my question.
I'm talking to
it seems to me, I'm not saying the developer can't do it, or I'm not arguing that he can. I'm saying the facts of this case is the developer changed the drainage plan after that lot was sold, didn't he? Didn't
yes.
he fill in the swale and build a wall?
Right.
And the argument is that in connection with the sale of the first lot, there was a drainage plan in place. That subsequent to the sale of that first lot, the developer changes the drainage plan to make other lots 1, 2, and 3, and the whatever that other thing is, saleable. Isn't the weakness of your argument the fact that it would otherwise relieve a developer who submits a master plan, according to which certain lots are developed? The lots get sold in accordance with this master plan, and then in a subsequent event, the developer decides to change that master plan. I mean, isn't the weakness of your argument that it would relieve a developer who was originally in the chain of sale from the liability for subsequent conduct that impairs that original chain of sale?
It may relieve him from a breach of warranty theory. It does not relieve him from liability. And one of my arguments is that there's no necessity to find this new breach of warranty cause of action. In essence, it's a negligence cause of action. As Carl Llewellyn said, the term warranty has no real meaning. If it has no fixed it's meaningless. And the legislature apparently is not bothered by legislating based on meaningless language, but I don't think this court needs to help that process by finding new warranties that are going to be extremely difficult to define, extremely difficult to limit. Now, I don't know if that answers your question. As a practical matter, I don't think the developer can or should be able to come in willy-nilly and change drainage plans without some checks. Number one, bad facts make bad law. In this case, obviously, something went wrong or something happened. It's happened that shouldn't have happened. But in the ordinary course, you've got a municipal authority with a civil engineer who's checking your drainage plan. You've got the developers hired engineers to prepare the drainage plan. I think that means my time is up. I don't know if
you may finish the question, the answer.
The developer is hiring an engineer to prepare the drainage plans. There are numerous checks and balances, and the consumer has a cause of action for negligence. He has a cause of action for trade practices for misrepresentation if he was told that the drainage would be a certain way. He has a cause of action for he has a possible cause of action for fraud. He has numerous common law causes of action, plus the protection of all the experts who are regulated by statute, plus the protection of the municipal, state, and federal authorities. Now, sometimes that may not be enough, but in the few cases that it's not enough, I don't think justify this court creating this nebulous new extension of the Melody Home warranty. Since my time is up, I'll sit down.
Any other questions? Any questions on the second and third major? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Powell will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, I'm Mike Powell. This is Amy Taylor. We represent the Woodruffs, the plaintiffs in the trial court, the respondents here. The nature of this case is very simple. We represent homeowners whose property was repeatedly flooded by development activities of a developer on an adjacent tract of land in the same subdivision. There's no real dispute they were flooded several times. There's no real dispute about the cause of that flooding, which was the wall and the fill dirt that Parkway, Sugar Creek, put in a couple of years after the Woodruffs bought their house. There's also no dispute that the developer was warned in writing and verbally by the Woodruffs before they completed construction of this wall that caused the flooding. Now, in broad terms, I think there are two, in very broad terms, there are two major issues before this court. One is whether the DTPA applies, and two is how much the Woodruffs recover. If the DTPA does not apply, I would submit to the court the Woodruffs do not get full relief. Because, for example, the basis for attorney's fees is eliminated. And without attorney's fees, they obviously are not fully compensated for the wrong and the expense that they incurred in correcting that wrong.
Can you recover attorney's fees under the water code?
I don't think so, Your Honor. We were unaware of any basis for doing that. We did not sue for them under the water code. Now, if I may, I'm going to skip over the consumer status for just a moment. Not because it's unimportant, but because I think that a lot of the questions from the court have raised a number of the issues that relate to consumer status. I personally think that consumer status law is fairly well established in this state and that the Woodruffs clearly fall within it. There's been quite a few cases, which I'll be happy to point out to the court, although I'm sure you're already aware of them, that talk about how privity is not required, how consumer status is established with regard to the transaction, and a person who enjoys the benefits or seeks to enjoy the benefits of the transaction may be subject to deceptive trade practice liability in this state. And I think that...
Based on misrepresentations?
Based on just the status, their status in the transaction as to whether they sought to obtain benefits from the transaction, whether they were any person who engaged in a practice that was prohibited by the DTPA.
There's a liability the foundation of liability is a misrepresentation.
Or one of the other prohibited practices under the DTPA, such as breach of an implied warranty, which I'm going to get to immediately, and unconscionable conduct, which was also found by the jury. Now, by way of background in this case...
Let me just ask you about consumer status. The sale that anchors the consumer status argument here occurred in 1977. And the wrongful conduct, which Parkway concedes was wrongful under at least one theory, occurred 6 years later, roughly. And the Court of Appeals seemed to say that the reason why there was a connection with the sale for consumer status purposes was because Parkway benefited financially from the sale of this lot 6 years earlier.
Yes.
Can you describe, is there any limitation, in your view, on the retrospective occurrence of a sale or a service that would limit the consumer status under these circumstances or under other circumstances we might hypothesize?
I am sure that there are circumstances where it would be limited. In this fact situation, I don't think so, because what the Woodruffs bought was part of a community, a master plan community, which is very common in today's economy, in today's world. Most people buy in very large communities that include all these development services. They're buying a package, not just the house. They're buying the streets and the drainage and the grading and the utilities, the storm sewers and so forth, and they're buying the belief that they're not going to be flooded. And I think if the development activities continue after the purchase, and that's certainly part of what they are purchasing. Mrs. Woodruff testified, for instance, that she saw a model of the master plan community. It was not completed when they bought it. So to say that they're buying part of it stops there, I think, ignores the realities of what goes on in the purchase of homes in these large subdivisions that are very common today. So shifting, if I may, quickly to the implied warranty issues. Let me back up just a minute. The jury did not find laundry list DTPA violations. They declined to do that. The jury found breach of an implied warranty that development services would be provided in a good and workmanlike manner. The jury also found that Parkway had engaged in unconscionable conduct with regard to the Woodruffs. Both of those findings were producing causes of damages to the Woodruffs. Now, I think that potentially the most troublesome of those findings is the implied warranty finding, because at the time of trial of this case, admittedly there was no Texas Supreme Court case that established or recognized such an implied warranty against developers to develop in a good and workmanlike manner. This Luker case, Luker versus Arnold, out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, was decided in 92 while this case was on appeal to the Court of Appeals. Ironically, we had no contact, and it was sort of from our view, a blessing that just sort of fell out of the sky. At the time we submitted this case to the jury, we patterned the jury instructions with regard to good and workmanlike after the Melody decision, after the language in the Melody decision. That's how the jury instruction was patterned. So I think the question really is whether this case, on its facts, presents a reasonable and logical reason to do a limited extension of the warranty that was established in Humber versus Martin and expanded to some extent in Melody Homes, and was also reiterated or reinforced in the Gupta versus Ritter Homes case. The reasons, I think, exist in this case to extend that implied warranty. If you'll recall, I know several of you are very familiar with this because you've written extensively on it. In the Humber case, what you were dealing with was an implied warranty to construct in a good and workmanlike manner to begin with. Then you get to Melody Homes, and you're talking about an implied warranty to repair an existing structure in good and workmanlike manner. The Gupta decision, which came in between, simply applied extended the implied warranty of habitability and good workmanship to a subsequent purchaser of the home. that further eliminated this privity requirement, which is really what I think Parkway is arguing in to a large degree. They're basically saying privity is required under the DTPA, and repeatedly that's been held not to be the case. But going back to the implied warranty, if you look at the stated reasons as enunciated in Gupta and earlier in Humber, there are a whole list of five or six reasons, and I'll call them policy reasons.
Counsel, let me just ask, those three cases you mentioned all involved either a defect in the at the time of sale or at the time of the service, which was the subject of the DTPA suit, didn't it?
Melody Homes also involved a defect in relation to repairs of the original defect.
This, the implied warranty here that the Court of Appeals found related to rendition of future services.
Correct.
And that's the extension you are arguing?
Yes, sir, that and the express recognition, and I mean a limited recognition, of an implied warranty for a developer to develop in a good workmanlike manner. And here's why I suggest it be extended. I think it's unrealistic in today's world to say that a builder, on one hand, has an obligation and implied the warrants to build in a good workmanlike manner and to repair in a good workmanlike manner, but to ignore the fact that the developer, which comes before the builder, really has as big or more of a role in the outcome of that house than the builder does. Because if they don't do the drainage improvements correctly, if they don't provide for proper drainage, even in their continuing development activities, then the house is not going to work no matter what you do. You're going to have exactly what happened in this case. Admittedly, in those three cases I cited, you were dealing with defects existing at the time, with the exception of Melody Homes and the repair defects.
This also is different, isn't it, in that the subject matter of the sale, that is what the Woodruffs purchased here, their home, that was not the location of the defective rendition of the defective service. It was on somebody else's property. Isn't that even a further extrapolation?
Yes and no, because if you look at the facts, the area that we're talking about that caused the flooding is literally at the northeast corner of the Woodruff property. This wall and fill dirt that was placed literally was at the corner of that property. It was all property that was being developed by Sugar Creek. This K-Nub tract that they were developing was a commercial tract for which they received a bunch of money when it was sold. The lot that this wall was placed behind was part of the Sugar Creek development. So yes, it was on an adjacent tract that was not part of Section 24 where the Woodruff lot was located, but it was all part of this master plan community that the Woodruffs bought into when they purchased their house. So I recognize that the implied warranty with regard to the developers in this case had not been enunciated by this court prior to the trial of this case. But I think this presents a logical opportunity to limit, in a limited manner, extend that warranty to this situation. Because otherwise, it's just illogical to say it applies to builders but not to developers.
If we don't extend this warranty, then can you not prevail on the implied warranty part of your case?
I'm sorry, if you do not extend it?
Well, your brief indicates that you say this is totally consistent with existing Texas law, but today you're saying actually it's going to be an extension, perhaps a logical one, but an extension of the law as it is.
The reason,
and that at the time you brought this case, you didn't have a Texas concordance.
That's right. When we say in the brief that it's consistent with existing law, I'm referring to the Luker versus Arnold case.
Okay.
And that is not a case out of this court, obviously.
So we have to recognize something that we've never explicitly recognized.
Or you have to approve of what First Court of Appeals and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals have done.
If we don't do that, then your only other ground for the DTPA portion of your recovery would be the unconscionability factor.
That's correct. That's correct.
And since the Court of Appeals did not reach those, we would have to remand to the Court of Appeals for a sufficiency review.
I believe that's correct.
Is there any authority contrary to Luker?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. In fact, my interpretation of the trend of decisions from this court going all the way back to Humber is, in fact, very consistent with it. And Luker, in the opinion, goes through and says, we don't have anything to guide us from the Supreme Court, but if you look at their pronouncements for the last 10, 15 years, this is logically where it goes. And there, if I might complete, there is an Indiana case cited in the Luker opinion, which is entirely consistent with that.
So while this court has not considered this precise circumstance, all you're really asking us to do is to approve the approach to that circumstance that every court of appeals that has considered it has taken.
Yes, sir. Exactly. And again, in a limited degree, I'm not asking this court to expand it into some warranty, implied warranty that applies to anything and everything in the future.
Mr. Powell, in one of the amicus briefs, they point out that an implied warranty of future development services encompasses professional services, that this case would actually involve the design of the wall and not necessarily the fact that merely the wall was constructed, but that whatever it was designed effectively, and argues that we have never recognized an implied warranty of good and workmanlike manner in the professional field. How do you respond to that?
Well, in two ways, Your Honor. First of all, I think it is inconsistent with the facts. I don't think that a developer's work is any more exclusively services versus the provision of goods than that of a builder. A builder provides some services and professional judgment in doing his job. So I think that what you're talking about here with a developer is really a combination of two. It's not just professional services. It does involve, in part, services. I'm not even sure I'd be willing to concede it's professional services, because what they're doing is simply grading the property so it'll drain, putting in streets, putting in storm sewers. They are actually putting physical goods on the ground that are acquired by the purchasers in the subdivision. So I think I would take issue in part with that conclusion by Amicus Curiae.
Well, I guess my question is along those lines. If the argument is not that because we bought this lot, understanding that's the way it was otherwise going to be developed, and they didn't develop it that way and we've been damaged, but their argument really is that whatever they put out there was defectively designed, that's not a construction issue, that's an engineering. These engineers didn't make this design a good one in a workmanlike manner. If that's the case, isn't that really an implied warranty on the part of a service as opposed to the product that was provided?
Well, that's the argument that Sugar Creek Parkway tried to make the trial court, and they really weren't successful on that. What was found was, and this is brought out in my cross-examination with Don Russell, the vice president of Sugar Creek, that it's the engineer who controls, not the engineer, excuse me, the developer who controls all of these decisions, that these engineers simply provide recommendations, that the developer can decide when to develop, which lots to develop, whether to develop them at all, how much to sell them for, what kind of improvements to put them on, what type of use to designate that particular tract for. So to try to put it off on the engineer, I think, is inaccurate, and to some extent that was rejected in the trial court.
Well, let me take it. If that's your position, then are the Woodruffs really asserting that they have some sort of vested interest in the design plan for the development? In other words, I bought my house on lot 24, but because it was part of a master development at the time I bought it, that the developer, I now have some right to enforce that master plan?
I think that they have a right to expect, and this is what I'm urging this court to say, that there is an implied warranty by the developer that they're going to do whatever they do in a good and workmanlike manner, because the Woodruffs have to rely upon them. They don't have the expertise to do it.
You've argued for what you call a limited extension of existing law under the Melody Holmes case, but I'm wondering what that limitation would be, because it seems like your argument would work just as well in the circumstance where I buy a home in a subdivision expecting that like homes, like quality, like value will be built in other locations, but let's say that the builder goes under and a new builder comes in and builds houses of lesser quality materials and lesser value, thus depressing the value, the resale value of my home, wouldn't this theory extend to that hypothetical?
I think what it extends to, and I hope this answers your question, is if the developer undertakes development activities that were part of its original package that was acquired, then it extends to that.
Let me ask you about the original package, because your clients didn't buy a lot. They bought a house from another homeowner. Is there a fee or anything they paid in addition to the sale price of their home to the developer here?
No, sir. Well, I say that too quickly. The developer got its money when it sold the lot to a builder to begin with.
6 years earlier.
Correct. I'm not sure whether there's a maintenance fee that they paid that in some way or another went back to Parkway or Sugar Creek. So there may have been some benefit. It would have been small in relation to the overall purchase. But the benefit that Parkway gets is they've got to develop this residential subdivision or they don't get any money. And as Mr. Russell admitted on cross-examination, that's the objective. We got to build the lots that people want to buy. And he admitted, yes, they have a reasonable expectation of not being flooded. That's part of what they're getting. You don't expect, they don't come in expecting that they're going to be flooded as part of what they're purchasing. And I think it's the facts in this case very pointedly show how the developer ignored the warnings, ignored the impact on Lot 24, the Woodruff lot, and just went ahead and did what it wanted to do on the Canaan track, or with relation to the Canaan track, even after repeated warnings.
Mr. Powell, let me change the subject a little bit. On the damages,
yes,
you have, it may make sense to say that even after you repaired the property, there's a diminution in value after the fact, and there might be some damages. But are the jury answers and the way the case was submitted, is it clear from the record that the Woodruffs were only awarded the value of the house plus any loss of value of the house after the repairs were made?
If I understand the question, absolutely. The way that the expert, Mr. Ozenbaugh, testified, his appraisal was assumed two different sets of facts, one with the property not subject to flooding, the other with subject to flooding. $240,000 with no flooding, $120,000 with flooding, and he disclaimed any expertise with regard to value based on structural damage and so forth. The cost of repairs are totally apart from and separate from the diminution in value. The diminution in value, and this is also the way it was submitted, I think it was question 17 in the charge, it asked specifically the jury to find diminution in value before and after flooding. Not with repairs, not with regard to repairs. Now the Love decision, which was decided by this court in 88, is different because the repairs in that case that needed to be made were the actual cause of the diminution in value. There would have been a double recovery there.
Well, was the jury told to exclude? I mean, you're saying there was no evidence before the jury that any of these repairs would solve the flooding problem. Is that what you're saying?
What they were told to find inherently excluded cost of repair as part of diminution in value because of the way it was defined. I can read it if you want.
Well, it'd be in the record, I assume, so.
Yes, sir. I think it's question 17 in the charge. But the way that the diminution in value question was phrased, it inherently excluded cost of repairs. It only inquired about diminution in value due to flooding. So it's two separate things. You fix the flooding, you still got the cost of repairs. You fix the cost of repairs, you still got the diminution in value due to the flooding. And Mr. Ozenbaugh's two different appraisals are in the record as exhibits, and that's exactly what they reflect.
But does question 17 contemplate or state that this is going to be the difference in value after you repair it? If you repaired it so you can get back in the house, then if you want to sell it, there's still a difference. Or does it ask the jury to compare the difference between a good house and a house wrecked because of a flood? In which case, it seems to me there would be a double recovery.
Okay. I'm going to read from question 17. What sum of money, if any, if paid down cash, so forth and so on, would fairly and reasonably compensate the Wooders for their damages? giving over, and diminution in market value of their house resulting from the flow of water on or across the Woodruff property. Drops down. Diminution in market value means the difference in the fair market value before any flooding and the fair market value of the property after any flooding. That, in my opinion, inherently excludes cost of repair because the question separately inquires about cost of repairs to the house, if I'm making sense. So I think the two inherently are mutually exclusive.
The opposing counsel contends that to meet the Lux standard, this question went into the phrase some different way and the error was there.
Well, if you look at the testimony of the experts, taken collectively, for instance, Ozenball, the real estate value expert, disclaimed in his opinion on diminution of value any reference to or expertise with regard to repairs. Mr. Dodson, hydrologist, testified the house was going to be in the 3 to 10 year floodplain. It was subject to flooding every 3 years. Mr. Pieper, the repair fellow who testified with regard to actually repairing the foundation and everything else that needed to be done, testified that these repairs would be separate and apart from fixing the flooding. So if you look at the testimony of these three experts, and there may be another one that I'm forgetting, it rather clearly and inherently excludes or separates cost of repair from diminution in value. And I'm not sure there was another way to submit it in this fact situation when you're dealing with a situation where it would be difficult or impossible to stop the flooding without Sugar Creek Parkway doing something to stop it. So all things considered, I think it clearly meets the LUT standard and fits within those cases or that reference in LUT that says, in the right case, you may be able to recover both. And I think that's what we did here. We pleaded and proved that there was a diminution in value due to the flooding, and then there was $127,000 in repairs that would have to be due irrespective of the flooding, and the flooding would have to be stopped first. I'd like to touch briefly, I'm going to skip over unconscionability because the Court of Appeals did not address that issue. The knowing violation of the DTPA, I think that's covered very adequately in the Court of Appeals opinion and our brief. Contingent fee issue, which was not addressed in the initial petitioner's argument, I really don't understand that argument because the case law in the state, to me, seems to be clear.
This court's never written.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. This court has not. The pattern jury charge approves submission of contingent fee issue. The expert witness that we provided at trial testified not just that a contingent fee was acceptable or reasonable. He also testified that he had reviewed the work done, the hours spent, so forth, all the factors that are contained in the code of professional conduct as to should be considered, and that all of those factors considered, one-third was a reasonable fee. It may have been low because it didn't include an increase in the event of appeal.
Aren't there some federal cases that present a fairly powerful argument as to why statute like this should not give an award on a contingency basis?
I think, and I'm not familiar with exactly the cases, but I think they may be in the context of mass court litigation or mass litigation.
In the context of a contingency fee is a gamble situation, and the attorney is making some money off of that fee that will subsidize some other cases that may not be successful. And in terms of a statute, giving an award, it should be limited to the fees that are incurred in this case. In other words, this defendant, under the sanction of law, shouldn't help subsidize other litigation.
Well, I think the evidence in this case addresses that because, again, the testimony was broken down not just with regard to contingent fee, but with regard to all the factors.
But was there testimony that a reasonable hourly rate would have amounted to a fee similar to what one third of the total
expense? I'm not sure those exact words were used, but yes, I think that you can interpret the testimony accordingly. That subject is addressed around page 44 of our brief in this court. And I think, I mean, I recall taking Mr. Dipple through virtually all the factors and whether he considered all of them and whether all things considered, not just the contingent nature of the litigation, it was reasonable here. Lastly, with regard to our mental anguish conditional point, assuming the court gets to that point, that seems to be based primarily, the Court of Appeals opinion seems to be based primarily on inadequacy of the evidence. I would suggest to the court that that question, mental anguish, is inherently subjective, and it's difficult to articulate a precise definition of what constitutes mental anguish. Clearly, there have been cases under the DTPA, if you have a knowing finding, which we did here, that you can recover mental anguish for property damage, and that's the basis of our claim for mental anguish. And I think that the evidence that the Woodruff supplied meets that standard. It certainly surpasses a no evidence point. It's very difficult. If your house were flooded, it would be very difficult to articulate every feeling that you went through. Multiple flooding, standing in water, carpet removed. We've been living for weeks with the smell of moldy water and so forth, which is what they testified to. They testified to the impact that had on their daily lives and their desire to come home and the pleasantness of that experience. Given the inherent subjective nature of mental anguish evidence, and I don't think this court has defined a standard for mental anguish evidence. If it has, I'm not familiar with it. I think the evidence that was submitted clearly passed the no evidence test and was wrong. That, see if I covered everything that was covered by petition. I think I did. If there are no questions, we obviously would ask that the court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, the alternative that it grant our application with regard to mental anguish. And again, if there are no questions, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I first want to address something that Justice Phillips raised about unconscionability. I don't agree that you have to remand this on the legal sufficiency point of whether the jury's finding of unconscionability should be upheld. I think in the interest of judicial economy, this court can go ahead and reach the question of legal sufficiency.
My question was intended to be factual.
I apologize. I misunderstood the question.
Maybe I said the wrong
thing. I hope this court would reach the question of legal sufficiency before
yes,
besides the remand
necessary. If we found, yes, we could look at legal sufficiency first, and only if we found.
Thank you. Just second issue I want to address, not necessarily in the order in which they were addressed by my opponent. I strongly disagree with this characterization of the expert's testimony regarding the diminution in market value being separate from repair costs. I've cited his testimony in my brief at page 36. There may be some confusion about the last statement wherein I indicate that Mr. Ostenbaugh stated that the house would still have a lower market value due to a stigma even if the slab were repaired and the flooding problem was removed. But he had not done any study to determine its value in a repaired condition. And that testimony is at volume 4, page 987, 988 of the Statement of Facts, which is in my brief, but it's cited just above the statement instead of just after it. I sort of did a general citation to the pages where his testimony was located. He also clearly, if you read his testimony, he was asked questions about damages to the property. He said he observed cracks in the foundation. He observed cracks in the sheetrock. And he observed other damages. And he said he took those into consideration in arriving at this estimate of market value.
His inspection was before the repairs?
Yes. He testified that he observed damages in the property. The Court of Appeals mischaracterized that testimony, as did Mr. Powell today. The Court of Appeals simply says, I think the Court of Appeals says something like, well, even if there were damages, it's clear that the thrust of this was because of the flooding and not because of the necessity for repairs. The 50% diminution is just because it's going to flood every 3 years. Well, that's an assumption they made that's not supported by the record. There's no testimony in the record that there would be a 50% diminution in market value even after repairs were made. And Mr. Offenbaugh, who testified to market value, was asked if he observed damages and did say he did observe damages, and his appraisal takes into account the fact that the house is in a damaged condition. So I strongly disagree with the characterization of the testimony. I also strongly disagree with the characterization of the question that was submitted in question number 17. It says, diminishing the market value, he read it right, but I disagree with his characterization. The diminishing market value means the difference in the fair market value before any flooding and the fair market value of the property after any flooding. Obviously, the flooding caused damages. The testimony was the flooding caused the slab to crack. The flooding caused the sheetrock to be damaged. The flooding caused the carpets to be ruined. The flooding caused mildew. So when the jury's looking at this and they're saying, well, what's the difference before and after flooding? Obviously, they would reasonably and logically take into consideration the damages to the house, caused the repairable damages, to be caused by the flood. So it did not attempt to exclude or differentiate any way between the damages solely caused by flooding, or the fact that it flooded and therefore would have a market stigma of some kind, and the difference in market value caused by the fact that it was in a damaged condition. There was no attempt to do that. I think we properly objected to that submission. What's more, there was no evidence. Even if this could somehow be construed as such a finding by the jury, there was never any evidence as to what the diminution in market value would be after repairs were made. Nobody attempted it. Their only market value witness said he had not done any study to determine its value in repaired condition. He hadn't looked at that issue. So there's no way that this does not fall under Lutby McCollum, in my view. Mr. Powell indicated that he did not believe that the plaintiff should get full relief in this case in the absence of a DTPA warranty of some sort of DTPA recovery because of attorney's fees. I would simply respond, that's true in any negligence case. And that's a whole area of public policy as to whether attorney's fees should be generally granted in favor of the prevailing party, which I don't think this court needs to address by logically extending a nebulous, ill-defined, undefined warranty. If you want to address that issue of compensating plaintiffs wholly and suing their attorney's fees, then address it directly. But don't do it by trying to find a warranty that you can somehow slide into the DCPA. There's lots of plaintiffs that they don't get compensated for attorney's fees, and if that somehow harms them, they're getting harmed every day. And that's a policy issue. But I think you hit it head on. I want to quickly try to make some distinctions between Melody Home and that warranty and the implied warranty that was found by the Court of Appeals and which the respondents are asking this court to find today. I've come up with six distinctions. The first is there was, and this is where I said this is not a privity argument. Parkway had no contract with anybody to continue to perform development services. They were not performing services on someone else's property. They were performing development services in Section 34 on their own property. So there was no contract or agreement to repair or modify someone else's property. And if there's no contract to modify someone else's property, how can you have a warranty to do it in a good workmanlike manner? I say that a warranty has to arise out of a contract. In that sense, there has to, but it's not a privity argument. I acknowledge that if there had been a contract with someone else, then at least the argument could be made that the plaintiffs were not a part of that contract, they may have some cause of action. I would you know, they might not get there with that argument, but at least it's arguable. But in this case, there was no contract. There's a fleet floating warranty into the indefinite future that's not anchored down to any theory of law. It's not anchored to any contract. Second, the scope of work. This is not repairing. Not repairing a toaster or even an automobile. It's not repairing anything at all. If repair means to put something back in working order. And it's not modifying anything the way this court defined modifying in Act 3 Arabians. This court was very careful in Act 3 Arabians. I think it's Archibald. To define modification to mean altering property without changing its essential character. And if anything changes the essential character of Ball, Prairie, and Rossfield around Houston, Texas, it's a residential subdivision development. You add streets, you add sewage, you add car exhaust, you add some good things, you add schools, you add roofs and housing for people to live in, you add churches, you add parks. It's not a simple modification. It's not what was intended, I think, by the legislature and what should have been intended by this court in Melody Home of the poor consumer going in and taking some piece of property to a repair service person or even having repairs made on your property. The third distinction is that there's no existing defect in this case, which I've already covered to some extent. And if you look at Hunger, Gupta, David Al, which is the implied warranty that rental premises and commercial rental premises will be suitable for their use. Any of those warranties, if you look, go all the way back to Jacob Decker and Sons, which was the granddaddy of all these implied warranty cases, that's a food case, a food defect. The defect has to be in the food when it's sold. That gave rise to product liability. Product liability. Pardon?
Your
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was
trying to get you and looking down.
Would
I
you
guess
just
I'm
list,
down.
Would you just list the other two distinctions without argument?
I have three more. It involves future defects. It's the same thing you're saying, it's not an existing defect, I guess. But it's undefined in the future. There's no limit. You can't tell the limitations around. It involves professional services, which I think has already been discussed. It is already heavily regulated, therefore there's already some protection. There's no need for this warranty to be adopted. It's going to raise home prices if it does anything. Even the consumers don't need this warranty. I'll stop if I have to. I apologize for taking so much time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Sorry.